The Artist Engineer, Technology in the 15th Century. The innovations actually introduced into the technology of the 15th century stand in contrast to the freewheeling ideas of the artist engineers. Where the drawings in the sketchbook soar beyond the existing means of realization, the changes introduced into the forges, workshops, and mines were nearly all small, practical, and incremental. Some were among the more down-to-earth of the inspirations of the artist engineers. Some were products of more obscure working engineers, and some were contributions of anonymous smiths, masons, and craftsmen. Wider diffusion of many devices is reflected in their familiar treatment in iconography, such as the carpenter's brace and bit, shown in the basket carried by a Roman soldier in Maester Francus carrying the cross. Taken altogether, the incremental improvements, newfound applications, and wider diffusions added up to a significant advance through the century, and pointed the way to the future no less than did the imaginative rendering of Leonardo and his peers. The turbine, a conception of Francesco di Giorgio, was actually put to work, though for an unexpected purpose. An advanced version of the water wheel, deriving power from water, passing through it to spin an outer runner, armed with blades, the turbine eventually powered steamships and electronic generators, but its 15th century function was to serve as a turnspit governor. The hotter the fire burned, the faster the hot gas spun the turbine above and turned the roast. Leonardo da Vinci proposed employing the turbine principle in a centrifugal pump to create a vortex high enough to spill over the containing vessel as a means of draining swamps. By this time, an anonymous inventor, probably in the Low Countries, had come up with a more practical idea, a radically improved windmill design. The tower or hollow post mill mounted the mill mechanism in a revolving turret that could be turned without needing to move the entire structure. The water was lifted either by scoop action of a vertical wheel or by an Archimedes screw. The other great prime mover, the water wheel, continued to expand its function, creating lakes and streams, while powering industrial operations that now included smelting, forging, cutting, shaping, grinding, and polishing metals. It helped produce beer, olive oil, mustard, paper, coins, wire, and silk. It lent its powerful assistance to fulling cloth, sawing wood, boring pipes, and ventilating mines. It supplied the power for an improvement in city water supply that began in South Germany with the introduction of piston pumps driven by undershot water wheels. The Chinese treadmill pedal wheel boat, an application of the water wheel in reverse, either reached Europe in the 15th century by stimulus diffusion or was independently invented. It appears in several manuscripts of the artist engineers and in the following century was built in Spain, where it was long used for harbor transport. One of water power's most important 15th century applications probably came in the task of pumping out mine shafts. Of the variety of pumps, bucket chains, animal treadmills, and windlass powered devices shown in Agricoli's classic De Re Metallica, some were certainly in operation in the 15th century. A famous one was designed by Jacob Turzo of Krakow to deal with the chronic water inrushes into the deep silver-lead mines of the Carpathians in Hungary. An endless two-drum bucket chain powered by an animal treadmill. The device became the technical basis for a major new mining enterprise of Jacob Fugger. Another anonymous innovation that appeared in the metal mines was the wagon mounted on wooden rails, drawn by animal power. The 15th century carriage makers supplied the future railroad with the pivoted front axle, ancestor of the bogie. In 1451, in the Austrian Tyrol, Johannes Funken invented a new smelting technique to separate silver from lead, an improved version of the cupellation process used by the Romans and described by Theophysis Presbyter. It involved heating cakes of lead, copper, and silver to run off into leadless, in which an experienced smelter could separate out the silver. The process supplied another technical assist to Jacob Fugger's mining and metallurgic enterprise, and to the Habsburg hegemony in Central Europe. The even better mercury amalgam process arrived in time to aid in the Spanish exploitation of American silver mines, also to the benefits of the Habsburgs. As the blast furnace and the refinery delivered an increasing supply of iron to the forge, the smith received help in handling it from the water wheel via a new device, the tilt hammer or trip hammer. A heavy iron head on a wooden shaft was lifted and released by a drum armed with cams. Rising, it struck on a wooden spring beam, and the spring's recoil added force to the downstroke. Alternatively, an iron block in the floor under the hammer tail achieved the same results. Around 1500, the slitting mill made its appearance in the iron-rich Liège district. The demand for nails was increasing. The new mechanism provided the smith with slender rods easily converted into nails. It consisted basically of a pair of rotary disc cutters turning in opposite directions, the first piece of true machinery after the power hammer to be introduced, and of even greater importance. In fact, it gave birth to the rolling mill, two iron cylinders powered by water wheel, flattening a bar of iron passed between them. Into modern times, the rolling mill remained a basic tool of the iron and steel industry. In the year 1500, iron production for the whole of Europe amounted to the impressive figure of 16,000 tons, according to the estimate of Rupert Hall. Nor was iron the only metal experiencing a boom. Church bell and cannons created a demand for bronze that stimulated larger and larger installations. Both bell and cannon required large quantities of metal and a high degree of skill. Bell metal, 23-25% tin, depended on precision in casting to ensure the proper ring. Among Leonardo's sketches are a reverberatory furnace to produce large quantities of metal for bell founding and cannon casting, and a crucible furnace in which six crucible pots were aligned in a sloping flue up which the flame swept like a blowtorch. The expansion of mining and metallurgy benefited agriculture by increasing the number of tools available and reducing their costs. Metal implements of every sort figured a great deal more commonly in the everyday life of the 16th century than in that of the 14th. A peasant anywhere in Europe had a far better chance than his great-grandfather of owning not only the basic complement of farm tools, but plow and cart, not to mention horse and oxen. In the wake of the Black Death, land too became cheaper, leading to two significant changes in land use. One was the shift to sheep farming, especially widespread in England, where open field villages were enclosed, the inhabitants sent packing by their new owners, and the land turned over to the sheep. Shepherds and their dogs moved into the manor houses, while the village dwellings slowly fell to pieces. A second change, especially noticeable in central Germany, was the regeneration of forests, where clearings were abundant for lack of labor to cultivate them. Scrub, birch and hazel took over the empty fields, to be replaced in time by beech and other tall forest trees. George Duby writes, "The return of natural vegetation in the 14th and 15th century is an episode of equal importance to the adventure of clearing the wastes." The enclosure movement reflected the continuous growth of the textile industry, which in the course of the 15th century improved both its spinning and weaving instruments and introduced changes in the organization of work. New patterns of consumption developed, and geographical shifts in manufacture took place. An attachment to the spinning wheel, the flyer spindle, sketched first by Leonardo and once believed to have been invented by him, is now known to have been borrowed from the silk throwing process and long used in spinning wool in northern Italy. In this device, as the spindle turned, a flyer revolved around it at a different speed, giving the yarn an extra twist. Fork and spindle were moved by separate wheels, powered by the same transmission belt, but turning at different rates because of their different diameters. The final medieval improvement to the spinning wheel, probably occurring late in the 15th century, was the addition of a treadle to power the wheel, leaving the spinner's right hand free to regulate the delicate task of feeding the raw material to the spindle. The result was a product that was more regular and of better quality. In the organization of work, while the putting out system survived in Eastern Europe, it was gradually replaced in the West by the beginnings of a true factory system. In some places, the factory was partly dispersed. In Florence, a cadre of finishers was employed in a merchant shop, while the weavers continued to work in their own homes. In both home and workshops, bell rang for the beginning and the end of a working day, as well as for meals, and inspectors regularly monitored all the workers. In a second form of factory that appeared in England, the sheep-raising landowners established production on his own manor, outside the jurisdiction of both city and guild regulation. At first, as in Florence, the workers labored in his own homes and were visited by inspectors. Later, they sometimes operated in a central workshop, such as the one described in the 16th century ballad. The establishment of Jack of Newbury, according to this ballad, was equipped with 1,000 looms and employed over 1,000 persons, all under one roof. More reliable accounts describe similar but more modest arrangements. The historian John Leland tells of an entrepreneur who installed his textile factory in an abbey, in which every corner of the vast houses be full of looms. Later, the same man acquired another monastery, laying out streets around it, each dedicated to a special function of cloth production. As wages rose and prices fell in the aftermath of the Black Death, patterns of consumption shifted. The wool and silk industries found it profitable to produce less expensive fabrics to appeal to a middle class of customers, while cotton and linen manufacturers exploited the lower end of the market, providing peasant households with their bedding, table linen, and undergarments to take the place of their traditional homespun. To serve the new customers, cloth-making centers specialized in cheaper grades sprung up in England, Holland, Germany, France, Spain, and Switzerland. The northern Italian cotton industry received competition from southern Germany in the form of a cheap but durable fustian, a mixture of linen and cotton known in Europe for at least 3 centuries but now mass-produced. The German fabric was woven with a warp of local linen fibers and a weft of cotton yarn imported from Venice and Milan. Later, the weft was also produced locally, spun from bales of raw cotton bought in northern Italian ports and transported over the Alps. The German fustian industry, which founded several fortunes including that of the Fuggers, was decentralized and largely rural. Merchant capitalists in the towns employed numbers of weavers in the countryside, who enlisted local spinners to spin the cotton weft thread and bought linen warp in the local market. The weavers were less skilled, less supervised, and more poorly paid than those of the Italian cities, accounting for the lower quality and price of their products, which gradually undermined the Italian cotton industry. A shift completed in the 16th century moved cotton from the Mediterranean ports and Italian cities to the Atlantic ports and northern Europe, with raw material beginning to come from the New World. In civil engineering, Renaissance architecture created a building boom whose principal technological advances came in lifting machinery, such as the counterweight pulley hoist devised by Brucinelli, which allowed a rope drum to reverse and set down a load without disturbing the motion of the winch or animal treadmill, and which delivered stone blocks, brick, lime, sand and water for the cupola of the Florentine Duomo. 2 pinions, an upper and a lower, could be made to connect with a large wheel, lifting the load or the counterweight. The long-standing problem of lock gates was mastered by an idea from China, given perfection by Leonardo da Vinci. Early lock gates, either a simple double door swing on hinges or vertically portcullis that lifted straight up, offered insufficient resistance to the pressure of the water on the upstream side of the lock, and the portcullis type had the disadvantage of needing a high clearance for the boats. The Chinese design that reached the West in the 14th century provided double doors facing upstream at an obtuse angle so that the pressure of the stream only forced them more tightly together. Leonardo, after studying the locks in the Visconti canal system around Milan, added a stylish touch, mitered gate edges that met in a snug fit. Water was admitted to the lock basin through small sluices cut into the gate. The mechanical clock spread rapidly in the 15th century, becoming a feature of private houses as well as royal palaces and communal towers. A late 15th century invention, the mainspring, second in importance only to the escapement, made timepieces not only portable but cheap. The pocket version got its name watch from town watchmen who took to carrying it. But although the watches had alarms and struck the hours, they kept only indifferent time. The trouble lay in the variable torque of the mainspring, which grew weaker as it unwound. The solution lay in the fusee, applied to clockwork in Prague in 1424. It was a cone around which a cord connected to the spring was wound. As the spring uncoiled, the diameter of the cone increased, augmenting the leverage and compensating for the weakening of the spring's pull. In the decorative art, two landmark technological innovations appeared. Oil as a painting medium was mentioned already by Theophilus Presbyter in the 12th century, but egg-based tempera reigned supreme until a process for refining linseed oil, producing a volatile solvent, was developed, mainly in Venice. Pigments dispersed in the treated oil created a responsive medium, exploited early by the Van Eyck brothers in Bruges and a number of artists in Italy. The maturing of the casting art encouraged the creation of bronze statuary, the first equestrian figure to grace a public square. A statue of the Florentine condottiere Erasmo Gattamelata was executed in 1453 by Donatello, who also cast a statue of David for the Medici Palace, the first bronze fountain piece of the modern world. Thus, the medieval technology made a direct contribution to art. It made a larger indirect contribution in helping to create such fortunes as that of the Medici. Besides Donatello's statue of David, Cosimo de' Medici commissioned several Madonnas by Fra Lippo Lippi, frescoes by Fra Angelico, one of the first great equestrian frescoes by Andrea del Castagno, and a Madonna by Flemish master Rogier van der Weyden. For his own private chapel, he also commissioned, by Bonozzo Coselli, a procession of the Magi. This procession included portraits of members of the Medici family, thereby putting his own family on center court.